Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone. Good morning, folks. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. Steve Williamson here and Mike Costantino. We've been away for 5 weeks. We've been doing reruns, or what do you call them, Mike?
We call them
rebroadcast.
Previously enjoyed programs. Rebroadcast. We're happy to be back. This is great. We missed it. I think we like to think we were missed. The live shows. On the other hand, they were great. Rebroadcast of our old shows. We've covered a lot of material over the years.
I've gotten a lot of comments on the Juan Cole show we did on Islam.
Yep.
People really like that. Somebody told me that you were really brilliant on that. They must have made a mistake, and it was me they were referring to. But so we are back. It felt really weird to be gone in the middle of this virus. It felt really strange. We have almost had no rebroadcast in all our years of broadcasting until the virus.
We work holidays.
Yeah, we work it all. It felt weird. I've been looking at Mike since 2011 every week.
Yeah.
So I'm still kicking. We got a good show for you today, don't we, Mike? Who we got on? Well, you folks probably know.
Yes, absolutely. We got Gary LeMaster. This is one of the little known facts about Gary LeMaster is that he's a prolific political writer and a very good one. He does LeMaster's Corner, a blog that is on the internet since he left, advertising, I guess, and left full time work. He has been doing LeMaster's Corner, which is a political blog, and this is his third book. It's got a great title, certainly appropriate for the time.
Yep.
Truth Over Politics. Truth Over Politics. He doesn't spare the Democrats. He never has, quite frankly. He was sort of a co-host on this show. And still is when we need him once in a while.
Call him silent, Gary LeMaster. I wanted to read his subtitle.
Yeah, go ahead.
Reclaiming Truth from Partisan Politicians. Gosh, the partisanship has even infected the response to the virus. Foreign influences. God knows that's a problem. Dishonest media and compulsive liars. So reclaiming truth from partisan politicians, foreign influences, dishonest media and compulsive liar is the subtitle of Gary's book, Truth Over Politics. How long have you been working on this one, Gary?
Hello, Gary, with us.
Gary?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Oh, no, I didn't hear that last bit. All right, so...
The question was how long you've been at this activity.
Well, this is kind of an outgrowth of the first two, although I tried to make this one less partisan and focus on things I thought I could substantiate and call truths. And like you said, I haven't spared Democrats in this. So I've been working on it off and on for 10 years, if you look at the research. But the actual writing, I think I spent about 3 months on it.
And it's been out now as a Kindle a book for some time. That's where I got my copy. But you told us just before we went on air, you told Mike and I that it's coming out now in paperback.
Yeah, the paperback's now available. Publishing, if you do it the traditional way, it takes forever. If you self-publish, and I've been using Amazon, but I'm looking at other self-publishing outlets, for the future. But if you do self-publishing, you can generally put it out in about, from the time you finish writing it to the time it's actually available, it's about a 2 weeks to 3 weeks. So it's been available on Kindle for about a month, and the paperback has been available for a couple of weeks, but the printing has been, delayed by the coronavirus, so I just got my first shipment last week at the end of the week.
Another little note on go ahead.
I want to point out that Gary's latest book is listed at Amazon at $985.
This is the one before this one.
That was my first one, yeah.
Why is it $984 for the Tea Republican book that you wrote?
Because Amazon, when they come down to the last issue, I blocked its sale, that and the second one, because I wanted to focus on this one. So as soon as they get down to the last copy, they start out with the price being the last copy being $1,000, and then it gradually goes down. So, and I don't get a dime of that. So. if anybody would buy it, which I doubt they would, I wouldn't get a dime of it.
It was surprising to see that I guess it was your first book was for sale for $984. We complain to the professors when they're on their air that the books that they're talking about, you go to Amazon or some other bookstore, Barnes & Noble, whatever, and it's like $64 for the book, or $85, or $122. But we find out that you secretly have a book for $984.
Another note on the process here, Gary, did you try to shop the book to publishers?
No, because it takes.
You went
too
straight
long.
Straight to self-publishing.
For political books, I feel like it. Regardless of whether they're partisan or nonpartisan, I think it things change so rapidly now that I think by the time you would wend your way through the agents and publishing houses and actually get it into publication, it would be very difficult for the data to be recent. And this book is focused almost entirely on data, that I've found from sources I consider reliable, like the World Bank and OECD.
So let's start talking about the contents.
Yeah, I'd like to go first on that, because actually it's, I think, the first section of the book, which is on corporations and multi-corporations. And a lot of what you talk about, and what's really interesting in this book, folks, is a lot of the statistics and the comparison of data, the tax rate for businesses in the United States, the effective tax rate is the same as Tanzania or somewhere, So Gary's, the book is filled with this, and I think even liberals or progressives are not focusing on the fact of the consolidation of businesses in a few hands and the breakdown of competition.
Yeah, I think, one of the things that I started the book with, because I thought it was the most important aspect of what's been going on over the past 40 years. And I should point out, this everything in the book is basically the result of the past 40 years, beginning in the 80s. But the consolidation has been extreme. It's Mike mentioned Amazon. It now controls the book business. And it and two discount department store chains basically control the majority of the retail business. You have three corporations that control most cell phone communications.
And they're consolidating airlines. Still, Gary, I think. And also our airlines. Pardon? Both the control of cell phone communications and airlines seem to be still consolidating. They're still in the active process of more of it happening.
Yeah, you have four right now, but two of them are consolidating. So I it's the merger has been approved. That's Sprint and T-Mobile. So I pared it down myself to three. But I think the most disturbing bit of consolidation is takes place in the food chain and the healthcare industry and in particular the media. There's now six corporations control more than 90% of all media in the United States. I find that absolutely frightening. That, you know, it's not many years ago that number was in the thousands of media companies, but the consolidations began with the end of the Fairness Doctrine in the 80s, and it's just continued and continued and continued. If you know the entertainment portion of it, like Netflix and Disney and so on, is becoming more fragmented, but the sources of our news are heavily consolidated.
Yeah, I think entertainment, what you're seeing, for example, is more and more small channels specializing in certain kinds of entertainment. So there's one that I subscribe to that is mostly European mysteries and crime shows. And that's a specialty, but you have some I don't know who owns these things, but some of them are broken down to show horror movies or whatever. So in terms of entertainment, there seems to be a lot more variety, and also they've really dug back into some old movies.
Well, I want to jump into some different kind of content in the book. The name of the book is Truth Over Politics, and Gary tries to point out the discrepancies, the huge, huge discrepancies. Food shortages and dairy farmers throwing milk away. Food shortages and throwing potatoes away. This insanity of a corporate distribution system, the insanity of corporate farming, we're shipping healthcare products, we're shipping protective equipment to other countries, while our own hospitals are screaming and little old ladies are sitting at home making masks and gowns American corporation after American corporation have said, we have offered, the order never came from the federal government. So, and this is once again truth over politics. Gary ends it with compulsive liars. This is a fascinating and yet horrible time. When you have a compulsive liar in the Oval Office, when you have a sociopath, I consider him a psychopath because he cares nothing about American lives. He has shown that time and time again. This is the truth over politics. The last truth I'm going to say that of course is most important to me, or at least is the topic of my thoughts today, is Gary's book says quite accurately, six corporations own 90% of the media. Six corporations own 90% of the media. Places like Chasm Radio have all but disappeared. For want of a better term, a mom-and-pop media outlet is unheard of. They should enshrine this place in porcelain or whatever they do, however to preserve it.
I think that would be hard on Tom.
But yeah, he's about half enshrined in porcelain already.
Yeah, he's got a porcelain shirt on today, so he's headed that direction.
The point is, this is an opinion show. However, we pride ourselves on our accuracy and research. We do have a point of view, and we consider it reason. Reason has a liberal bias. The truth has a liberal bias because we hear so many lies.
So, Gary, what if you looked at your book like we're looking at it, and I look at it, and I think that the corporation thing is the most interesting, and Mike looks at it and thinks the media thing is the most, what do you think is the most important issues that you raise? Let's skip climate change because we can do that another time, but other issues, what do you see?
I think the biggest thing is the structural problems that we've created over the last 40 years. As Mike was talking about, we have food shortages and we have miles long lines of cars and people, getting to food shelves because they can't make a living right now. And we have, probably 20%+ unemployment now. And Arizona is one of the few states that's really opening back up, and I and it may be, you know, ill-conceived. I think that the biggest thing to me is the structural problems. You have hospitals. The problem with the PPE was that hospitals adopted the corporate just-in-time philosophy. In other words, we don't want to spend any money on equipment that we may need down the future, you know, in the future. We want to just-in-time it. So we don't want to spend for the inventory. We don't want to spend for spaces to store that inventory. We know how much we go through on a typical month, and we're going to just purchase that amount every month, and we'll do it month after month after month. Well, let's turn around and bid us in the behind. The same is true of the supply system for food. You know, we have all of these corporate farms now. It's one of the worst aspects of consolidation is that I point out in the book that in 1950 we had 20 million people living on farms. And in 2012, the most recent date that I could find, there were 3.2 million people living on farms. So nearly 17 million people have left farms. And that has, you know, killed the, you know, it's one of the problems of grievances of the people that voted for Trump that were unhappy is that the rural towns have just dried up. You know, my hometown is you know, a tiny little white spot now compared to what it used to be.
And mine's just a suburb of Tulsa now.
I see a bill from Elizabeth Warren and someone else to outlaw industrial farming?
I would love to see that.
One of the things I saw, Gary, that I think dovetails.
People aren't really familiar with that concept of industrial farming is if you look at hog production, what happens is like Smithfield or Cargill or one of the large corporations approaches a farmer and asks to lease some part of their property and hire that farmer to oversee the production of the pigs in their factory. And so they'll build a hog facility on this farmer's farm, hire him to operate it, and so you've got this vertical integration that's gone from the land up through the food supply chain. Well, now what you're facing with the coronavirus is that the whole supply chain was built around supplying schools and restaurants. That was the largest, you know, the largest buyers of food in the U.S. And so when we shut down the restaurants and the schools, there's no place for that food to go. We have truckers out of work. We have farmers producing the product. You would think it would be a simple, way of getting it to the people who need it, but it's not set up that way. And so now they're trying to scramble to figure out how they can redirect that food supply to the people who really need it.
The other thing I think, was reading, Gary, was just to give an example of what you're talking about is a case where this farm, 1,400 acres or something, was owned theoretically by 11 people who received subsidies as owners and farmers. None of which practically were involved in actually running the farm. So the whole system, particularly the latest batch that Trump did, of paying farmers, almost none of the money goes to people working the land. At least that's my understanding. Is that yours?
Absolutely true. And in southern Minnesota, where I live, southeast Minnesota, it's you know, in the midst of farming territory. And there's a lot of dairy farms around here. A lot of them are bankrupt, and a lot of them will be closing down because they're family owned. And the dairy farms, by the way, I grew up in a family farm in the '60s, and we milked cows, a few. and I worked on the dairy farm and in college during the summer months for a couple of years. And we at that farm we milked about 80 cows. Well, now you're talking about a small dairy farmer, a family farmer, who has maybe 1,000 cows that are being milked, and they have a system that's set up where the cows essentially milk themselves. That it's on a large turntable. And so the cows come in to eat, and when they come in to eat, they're directed into a stall. A robot puts the milking machine on the cow, and she's milked, and when she's done, then she can go eat. And it's just, it boggled my mind when I found out what has happened to the family farm.
So much of the money that's, there's so much talk, Gary, and I think that you helped puncture this of helping the family farmer but as you point out, almost none of the money goes to actual people working on the farm. A lot of them are laborers who don't even own anything.
Yeah, there are lawyers that are set up to help farmers, turn their farms into corporations, and in doing so, will list all of the farmers' cousins and aunts and uncles and other relatives as partners in the farm. And so those people may never have anything to do with it, including any form of investment in the farm. But these farms keep growing and growing and growing. And with regard to the subsidies, when the subsidies went out because of the embargo or the tariffs on China, when the subsidies went out to support the family farmers, they're distributed to all of the nephews and nieces and aunts and uncles and cousins, et cetera, as well. So, one of the documentaries I saw showed the addresses of the people that were receiving these subsidies, and it was all the same address.
Right, but, and otherwise they're not involved. I wanted to ask Klaus, are you there? Are you listening in?
Yeah, I'm
what
here.
What did you want to talk to? You were interested in just shifting the topic. We can go back to it, Gary. But I think Klaus was interested in the stock buybacks and some of the economic things that were in your book.
What happened is that companies got this big tax relief and this gift of a whole pile of money. And the hope was, and I think even in the Trump administration, that they would, build additional factories and hire additional workers and so forth. But what happened instead is that the companies bought back their own stock. And to explain how that works, let's assume that a company has 1 million shares out. Well, it's usually much more, but 1 million shares out, and the stock trades at $12 a share. If you buy back half of the shares, the stock will go to 24, because it's fewer stocks covering the same assets. So it's a huge boon for the corporate leaders, because they all own the stock overnight. Practically, their wealth in that particular stock doubled. So it didn't have tax reliefs didn't really have any. Well, I shouldn't say any, but had little economic growth associated with it. It simply made the owner, well, the majority owners of the corporations more wealthy than they already were. So that was the story with the buybacks.
Gary says in his book, Klaus, that with Trump tax cuts to corporation, companies spent $4 trillion of their cash on stock buybacks, much right. of it since the $4 trillion, they took the money from the tax cuts instead of expanding their businesses. They did stock buybacks with it. I think that's an issue hard to explain to folks, but an important one.
I would point out that I call that part of the Reagan effect, because there was, in, you know, most of these problems with the consolidation and the inequality and wealth and income and opportunity have happened as a result of the trickle-down theory of economics, which has been repeatedly debunked, but they keep pushing it. But the stock buybacks were illegal until the 1980s. And then it was in the 80s that the corporate executives got their income tied to the performance of the stock prices. So as soon as the buybacks were made legal, suddenly the corporate executives started, you know, profiting like never before. And as far as, like, you know, we did as part of the 2017 tax cuts, there was another repatriation of money held offshore by large multinationals. And when I attack corporations, I'm really talking about multinationals across the board. If small corporations are not benefiting from very much of any of this. But the multinationals were supposed to repatriate, you know, the trillions of dollars that were stashed offshore to avoid taxes. And they were given a lower tax rate to bring it back. Well, some of them did. It was actually a relatively small percentage of it. But these people had lobbied for the repatriation. And they promised that they would, you know, create all these jobs. That never happened. The money went to stock buybacks instead. And so the executives profited. But it was entirely predictable, because the same thing happened in 2004 when they had another tax repatriation under Bush. And instead of creating jobs, which they promised, it actually cost about 250,000 jobs. Because they could just consolidate even more. It's been an ongoing scam, this whole trickle down theory and the tax cuts for multinationals has been just an ongoing scam for more than 40 years.
And Trump actually convinced people that this tax cut would benefit them. And, of course, when we see all the statistics, the money all went to, or almost all the money went to large corporations for things like stock buybacks, which don't seem functional in terms of improving the economy that much. Maybe they have some positive effect, but it's tiny compared to
what they don't. They don't have any effect.
So the stock buybacks are not, Klaus, are not good for the economy in any way, you say? Yeah, I mean, you're the economist, I mean.
Well, quasi-economists. No, they they did is, you know, reduce the number of shares outstanding, and thereby made the people who own the shares richer, right?
One of the things that if you're a little stock investor and there's a buyback, don't sell your stock at that time.
There you go.
Because that's the scam. The little guys sell their stock when they hear these things, and the big guys keep it and get rich.
As much as I rail against unregulated capitalism, which is my biggest problem. If we keep on wanting to look behind things, which we want to do on democratic perspective, I'm surprised to learn that over half of Americans are invested in the stock market in some way, either through a pension or directly.
Right.
I'm not one of them. My pension, my tiny little minuscule teacher's pension from the state of Arizona is not allowed to invest in the stock market. And so not even through that am I a member of. But the point is, so it's hard for wild-eyed liberals like me to put down the stock market so much when so many regular rank-and-file working Americans do depend on it in some ways. but there are, but the Dow is not the economy. I've been posting a meme lately. Die for the Dow. That's what the Republicans are asking us to do. You are supposed to die for the Dow Jones average, and they're making no bones about it. That mass death is now a Republican platform, which sounds real. But I want to get into media. I want to talk about Gary's book.
Can I add something to the
sure.
Die for the Dow? And that is this latest round of now approaching $3 trillion of bailout has largely gone to large corporations. And guess what they're doing with it? Stock buybacks. You know, if you wonder
it's
why
astonishing. This was supposed to go to small
soaring,
businesses like, say,
while
a restaurant or a hotel in Sedona, and it ended up going to chains. I mean, I know they need money too, but the money. How did it happen, Gary? That the money all ended for the small business loans all ended up going to large businesses.
Well, not all of it, but a large part of it, and it. As I understand it, it was primarily due to banking relationships. If you were a corporation, you know, large enough to have a line of credit with a bank, as my former companies did, and so you had an ongoing relationship, your bank was standing ready to help you, you know, weed through the paperwork to get the bailout. But if you're a mom and pop kind of operation, small retail, you know, small restaurant, small, you know, clothing store, whatever, and you didn't have that kind of a line of credit and relationship with a bank, you were kind of on your own. And those people were all late to get their applications in because they didn't have the help. And by the time they got in, the money was gone.
Yeah, I'm sorry. The whole thing did not seem to help small business. It did seem that people and small businesses were thought of last. With 80-85% of the $3 trillion you just mentioned went to millionaires, billionaires, and large corporations. The stimulus, I have not got my $1,200 check. By the way, IRS, if you're listening, it's in the middle of May here, I've not got my measly $1,200. I could really use it. I will stimulate the economy with it. I will not buy any stock. But I do want to talk about media. In Gary's book, he talks about Fox, of course, but he talks about Sinclair and OAN and others who control 90% of the media. Sinclair, 7 out of 10 adults get their news from Sinclair Corporation. If you wonder why people are arguing, if you wonder why people are shooting
it. Usually owned local stations. Sinclair is a huge corporation that you don't see, folks. I just want to clarify. And they own a whole lot of the television
stations.
Own
a whole lot of local stations.
All over the country.
And they just tried to buy Tribune Media. They were trying to become a real competition to Fox, an even more conservative, and even more of a spokesman. You understand? This has nothing to do with news. This has nothing to do with pretty weather girls in short dresses. This has to do with being a Trump outlet, a completely wholly owned subsidiary of the Trump propaganda machine, is Sinclair Broadcast. The station is owned by David Smith, whose father founded the business in 1971.
They've interfered, folks, They interfered with the presentation of local news. In other words, they take over a station, they say, oh, hi guys, nothing's really going to change, and then they begin to work in their right-wing political agenda. They have shut down or criticized local people for their production of news, and they shape it to this agenda. And unlike Fox News, Mike, what strikes me is they're pretty much invisible.
Let me make a correction. If the Tribune deal with Sinclair had gone through, and I'm looking at a New York Times of just a couple of days ago. If the Tribune deal had gone through, then 7 out of 10 would have gotten their news from Sinclair. believe it or not, the current state of this story is that the FCC may be the last bastion of democracy, or one of the few left in America, rather than allow the deal to go through, has fined Sinclair $48 million for its open and corrupt dealings and its open and corrupt favoritism of the Trump administration. I mean, actually, that's not why they're getting the fine, because of the way they conducted the deal in trying to take over Tribune Media and trying to buy Tribune Media. Like I said, 7 out of 10 do not currently get their information from Sinclair. Had the deal gone through, and if and when the deal goes through, then we are screwed that way. This is what the book is talking about. This sort of truth over politics, this sort of multiple fronts, food, medical equipment, media, all these really important things, if America has changed, that's part of the argument. I can't talk to my relatives anymore because they don't, you know, this is a cliche now, but Walter Cronkite isn't delivering the truth to all of us, you know, at 5 o'clock every day, like in 1974. It's just not happening. It's fragmented beyond control. And I don't know. It makes me rather hopeless. Gary, is there any hope? We got about 10 minutes left. Give us some hope here. Your book, as many of them do, by the way, lists the problems. How can we fix this crap?
Let me go.
You have 1 minute, Gary. I'm kidding.
To your mentions of Sinclair and the media, I wouldn't give too much credit to the FCC. Because like everything else in politics now and in our government, it's absolutely frozen because it has equal numbers of Democrats and Republicans. And so it really doesn't do much of anything. The only reason Sinclair's, you know, deal with the Tribune was blocked in my belief is that it was for the way they went about it, but not for the content. The Sinclair, you know, has taken advantage of the belief of a lot of Americans that they no longer, because of Fox and others, they no longer trust the national news. So they've decided to get their news from the local media. And that Sinclair has taken advantage of that because they have mandatory editorials that each of their stations has to play at least once a week. And so they are, in effect, you know, part of the propaganda network. As far as hope, I don't know what's going to happen with the coronavirus. I suspect that we're going to have another wave of deaths until we get to a real treatment and a vaccine. But it should cause us all to take a look at the structures that we've created over the past 40 years and try to assess where we're at and make changes and diversify some. You know, there's talk now that we'll repatriate some of the production of PPE and other medical equipment to the U.S., that would be a good start, but until you get universal health care, we're not going to be able to do much better with the pandemic than we have with this one.
I see Biden avoiding a lot of issues, but I see him talking about universal health care all over social media and all over regular broadcast media, and it seems like an issue that he's going to stick to. We're talking to Gary LeMaster. We're talking to a former co-host of Democratic Perspective. He's written his third political book, Truth Over Politics. And I'm going to ask him a couple of hard questions that we did not rehearse before the show. What's the first five things that Joe Biden should do? That's number one. You know, think about that for a minute. There are so many things that need Trump. We're talking about daily. We know this. Every day, there's an atrocity, there's a corruption. You know, William Barr, we can't go through this show without talking about not prosecuting friends of Trump's, people in Trump's campaign who were found, who confessed their guilt and were in jail. And yet the Attorney General of the United States won't bring charges against him. It was dropping charges, excuse me. We're talking about a level of corruption that rivals any and I don't want to put this whole banana republic thing is insulting, but any less developed government, we're talking about emerging cavemen here had more integrity than the U.S. government. So what are the first
parts of it that Trump controls? I mean, a lot of the government is still functioning in a correct way. You see,
yeah, I don't want to hear hope. I want to hear what I want to hear what Biden should do to get us back, to make it better. It's never going to come back, and people, the writers are saying that over and over. But how can we? What should Biden do? How's Biden first? How's he going to win it? And what's the first five things he should do that he says at his inauguration?
Well, number one, I think, is to take all of the, you know, collect all of the presidential orders that Trump, you know, put out, and he's you know, governed mostly by fiat, with one presidential order after another. I would nullify every single order that he did. I would have put a committee together to collect those and look to see if there's even one that's worth saving and nullify all the rest.
Yeah, I think that's important, Gary, to review them immediately and cancel them if there's not a good justification for them.
Could do it with one presidential order, I believe. The other thing is, you know, with the pandemic, you know, if Biden is elected, and I think this is going to be an incredibly ugly election season, Trump is going to lash out like never before. You know, if you consider what he's already done with the Ukraine and what the Republicans have done with voter suppression, I think this is going to be horribly ugly. But if Biden wins, I think he should set about nullifying as much as possible and bringing back regulations on the environment. But I think, given the pandemic, he has to address our healthcare system. That is one of our biggest structural problems.
I think one of the other most important and first things to do is to hire highly competent people to run the government, instead of, you know, people who are just friends of Trump and will say yes and amen to everything he says.
And I'd like to see somebody, you know, take a hard look at consolidation and try to deal with the monopolies that have been created. That's one of our significant problems. I'd like to see stock buybacks made illegal again. I'd like to see national usury laws established again. If you look, you know, I did a...
We've got 1 minute, Gary.
All right, listen, I want to leave you with this message. I want to think about a general strike. I want to think about stopping Trump now. Every day, if Republicans had any patriotism whatsoever, they would be exercising the 25th Amendment. The man is obviously crazy. He's obviously mentally disturbed. Everybody says that. He says that. 118 twits an hour says that. Tweets, excuse me.
This twits, Mike?
Well, whatever.
118 twits an hour?
Oh, my God. You're lucky it came out that way.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.